Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In this episode, I talk with Professor Jennifer Gossetti-Ferenczi about her new book, On Being and Becoming, An Existentialist Approach to Life. While existentialism has long been associated with Parisian left-bank philosophers sipping cocktails in smoke-filled cafes, or with a brooding, angst-filled outlook on life, Gossetti-Ferenczi shows how vital and heterogeneous the movement really was. In this concise, accessible book, Gossetti-Ferenczi offers a new vision of existentialism. As she lucidly demonstrates, existentialism is a rich and diverse philosophy that encourages meaningful engagement with the world around us, offering a host of fascinating concepts that pertain to life as we experience it. The movement was as heterogeneous as it is now misunderstood. Influenced by jazz music, involving diverse thinkers from around the world, challenging received ideas about the meaning of human existence. Part of the difficulty in defining existentialism is that it was never a unified philosophy, but came to identify a set of shared concerns about the meaning and possibility of human freedom, as it may be expressed in authentic choices, actions, and projects. Existentialists all explored how, in the absence of traditional reassurances about the meaning of life, we may transcend our present circumstances and give our situation new meaning. With existentialism, concrete, lived experience of the single individual emerged from the shadow of abstract systems and long-defended traditions and became subject matter in its own right for philosophical inquiry. Far from solipsistic, Gossetti-Ferenczi shows that existentialist attention to the human self can be intertwined with ways of conceiving the world, our being with others, the earth, and the encompassing concept of being. Fully appreciating what existentialism has to offer requires recognizing the rich diversity of its prospects, which involve not only anxiety, absurdity, awareness of death and the loss of religious meaning, but also hope, the striving for happiness, and a sense of the transcendent. On Being and Becoming unpacks this philosophical movement's insights and reveals how its core ideas promote creative responses to the question of life's meaning. Jennifer Gossetti-Ferenczi is professor and Karel Mayer Chair in German, and professor in philosophy at Johns Hopkins University. She is the author of four books, including On Being and Becoming, An Existentialist Approach to Life, as well as a book of poems, After the Palace Burns, which won the Paris Review Prize. Hello, everyone. I am Elizabeth Cronin, a host of the New Books Network, and today I am talking with Professor Jennifer Gossetti-Ferenczi about her new book, On Being and Becoming, An Existentialist Approach to Life. I'm so happy to have you here today, Professor Gossetti-Ferenczi. to talk about your book. And I'm wondering if you might start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in this field and in this topic.
Well, thanks very much, Elizabeth. Thank you, of course, for having me. And it's a pleasure to talk about the book. I've been interested in this subject, existentialism and existentialist philosophy, for a very long time. I have to say, although I say in the book that existentialism isn't only for young people, because it really is for everyone, I did find existentialism when I was young. And of course, it was my sort of introduction to philosophy in a way. The first philosophical texts I read were some of the existentialist writers. And I was probably first drawn to them, if I can remember correctly, through their literary writings. So I had always loved literature, and I loved modern literature in particular. And one of the kind of amazing things about philosophy in an existentialist style is it lends itself very beautifully to being expressed in a literary form. So I had come across some literary works by the major existentialist thinkers. And then I was drawn to their philosophy because, of course, the novels and stories are packed with ideas, or they're provocative of ideas that make you want to read further. So I developed an interest in philosophy, and I sort of went away from existentialism for a while. I wrote a lot about phenomenology, which is, as you'll find in the book, somewhat related to existentialism. I wrote a lot about the philosophy of literature, the philosophy of art or aesthetics, and some works on history of philosophy. But in my teaching, over the many years that I've been teaching philosophy and then literature, I came back to existentialism again and again. I found that whatever I was teaching about, these writers and thinkers just kept coming back to my repertoire, and students found them extremely appealing. So I finally, after many years of this, decided to write this book because it really was, in a way, a return home to my roots in the first kind of astonished awakening of discovering philosophy through a literary lens. And it was a way to be able to write for really everyone who might be interested in these topics in the way that I was, to give them an insight into how rich and diverse this kind of philosophical thinking can be.
I will say that you write this book in a way that's very accessible, so that you can read it without having an academic background, you know, on the subject. And I think that's really helpful. What do you think is the draw for you? You mentioned you keep kind of coming back to existentialism, and even as you teach it as a professor, what do you think is the appeal to the students?
Well, you know, the first thing you said about it being accessible is really important to me, because I have written a number of books before, and they have been very scholarly works with hundreds of footnotes and meant for sometimes an interdisciplinary audience, but often a very academic one. And I really did want to write for a broader audience this time. And this subject really lends itself, because I believe that existentialism is really motivated by its interest in individuality, its interest in concrete life. That might not seem so obvious when you pick up some of the great heavy books that the existentialists have written, like Being in Nothingness or Being in Time or some of Nietzsche's works. They seem very abstract if you are uninitiated into their vocabulary and their way of thinking, but actually they're all turning to the individual human life as the subject matter of philosophy. And that really is something unique and novel, because much of the history of philosophy is devoted to discovering truths that are universal, maybe even essences that seem to transcend the world that we can really experience palpably. And existentialism wanted to take the resources of philosophical thinking and turn them toward life as the individual person actually lives it. What are the concerns of our existence? What does it matter? What does it mean and matter to be an individual human being that is unlike any other human being, and yet is just as human as everyone else? Those are the kind of questions that are constantly being addressed in existentialism. And I think that's why students are continually interested in them. A lot of the knowledge that they are studying in other subjects is extremely important for understanding how the world works, whether the social world or the physical world, but very little of it is really devoted to the question of what it means to be a human person, what it means to be you, the individual as a human person, and what kind of meaning might your life have. So existentialism really appeals to people who are just thinking about their own experience in the world and about what it means to be here.
And so when I was reading the book, one of the things that struck me was the idea that existentialism also, well, just the connection of existentialism to one of the core ideas being freedom, and the idea that, because I think of it as being like the search for truths and, you know, the meaning of life and all that kind of thing. But what comes out in the book that I found interesting is that it also opens up the opportunity for an individual to reflect upon their unique circumstances and to break free from the constraints of expectations given their circumstances. So you could even think of how, like, it just opens up an opportunity for people to not be limited by the circumstances they're born into.
So you've asked about freedom as one of the core principles of existentialism, as well as the kind of search for meaning and the way in which we are not, according to existentialists, merely stuck in our circumstances. So let me try to put those things together a little bit. When you think about human beings from a number of different perspectives, you might come up with lots of different ways of explaining human life. You can look at us from an evolutionary perspective, a biological perspective. You could look at society from a wide perspective and find how it impacts the individual. You could look at the human being and human life from a religious perspective. Many different ways of looking at the human being could give explanations or accounts of the fact that we're here and how we are. But none of that really asks the question of what we want to be and what we might make of ourselves. One of the things that's really important to existentialists is that the circumstances that we find ourselves in are also interpretable by us. We aren't just arriving in a world that is already determined in all of its meanings, and we just have to fit into it like cogs into a wheel. Rather, it recognizes that we are free to reflect on our lives and to think about it in multiple possible ways.
Yes. And so I think something that you had said in one of the chapters, you talk about Socrates and how he points out that sometimes we mistake mere opinion for knowledge. And when you say that we actually have that capacity to incorporate information into our choices, that seems like an interesting kind of, I don't know if that's a nuance of existentialism, but this idea that we can actually try to check for when we are, when our perception is accurate or skewed in some way. That makes sense?
Yes, it does. I think it's really important that existentialism is philosophical. And of course, on the one hand, the history of philosophy, and I'm speaking primarily about Western philosophy for the moment. On the one hand, Western philosophy is concerned with universal truths and often not very interested very much in the individual experience. But starting with Socrates, and then in lots of different moments throughout the Western tradition, you do have a concern for and an interest in how we might think about ourselves and we might think about our lives and what we do. And of course, the fact that we have the capacity for reflection and understanding ought to be able to inform how we think about ourselves as well. So I think one of the things that existentialist philosophies in lots of different ways, because we'll probably get onto this, but there isn't just one existentialist philosophy, but many different existentialist approaches, but they all seem to want us to liberate ourselves from any predetermined or prepackaged or pre-given meaning or self-understanding, and to think about ourselves in different possible ways, and to recognize what freedom we may have for determining ourselves otherwise, or to thinking about our lives and our interactions with the world in new ways.
Right. So that ties back to, like, that sounds very liberating, that the idea that even if you had some, if you are born into a situation where it's sort of prescribed that you're supposed to go in this direction or into this profession, that you could exercise the ability to break away and come up with another path.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Now, it is a difficult thesis to hold that we are free. And increasingly, we seem to be aware of how freedom isn't simply a kind of faculty of ours that can be exercised in any way we wish, but rather it's always embedded in our circumstances. So this is one of the things that existentialists in different ways had to cope with. If we're free, to what extent we're free? Are we free? And in what ways can that freedom engage our circumstances? And in what ways do our circumstances impinge upon our freedom? So it's really important to recognize, on the one hand, the universal sort of principle that human beings have the capacity to elect to some extent their actions and who they want to be. On the other hand, it's really important to recognize that they all, as existentialists put it, are thrown into a world that they didn't devise. They already show up in a world that's full of meanings and that's full of social structures and political structures and economic structures and so on, that profoundly determine the circumstances in which they have to exercise their freedom, with which they have to interact. So sometimes existentialism can be described as a philosophy that overemphasizes individual freedom, particularly Jean-Paul Sartre's philosophy, for example. He's very famous for saying things that, like, we're absolutely free under any conditions, that we're condemned to be free, and so on. And he put a huge premium on the problem of human freedom and his insistence that that's the starting point. Our freedom is the starting point. But even Sartre, who was perhaps the most vigorous advocate of individual freedom, even he had to cope with and contend with the understanding that every time we act and react within the world, we are doing so within a set of circumstances that we didn't devise. And he called that facticity. And he borrowed, even he borrowed that term from Heidegger's philosophy. So the whole problem of freedom is, how is it that our free exercise of desire, will, action, decision, and so on takes place within complex circumstances? And how can we interact with those circumstances in a way that we put our own mark on them, we help to shape them, rather than accepting simply that they shape us?
So as I'm listening to you now, I'm thinking of, I just associated to Viktor Frankl and his book, you know, Man's Search for Meaning. And of course, meaning making as a part of existentialism. And thinking, like, there, you're acknowledging in a way that there is oppression, that there are societal structures that keep people, hold people back, that power isn't shared equally, and things like that. So I think that's an important part that takes it from a philosophy or theory to, like, that acknowledges, you know, the, like you said, I think you call them circumstances you're thrust into. And so that's where I think it gets really tricky, because so Viktor Frankl would say that even in amongst an oppressed situation, there's still the freedom of how you're going to respond, I guess, to yourself and to the people that you're, you know, that are also there with you. And so I don't know if you have some thoughts on that.
Well, I would like to think that it's so, that he would be one who very well understands the impact of incredibly oppressive circumstances. And the testament, even within such circumstances, to human freedom is really quite inspiring. On the other hand, I think that it's possible that we might have to be a little careful in understanding what it takes to be a free self, and whether or not there are ways in which we can be so impacted by circumstances that our self is compromised or that our freedom might be compromised. Now, one of the reasons why existentialists do vigorously defend that sort of core of human freedom is because that's also the justification for an ethical standpoint. Why must we respect other people as individuals? Why must we respect their freedoms? Because that's what it means to be a human subject or self. And to deny them freedom is to deny their individuality and indeed their humanity. So it is with good sort of ethical purpose that existentialists want to defend the core of the human self as a free self. At the same time, many existentialists, including Sartre and Beauvoir and Camus, were very interested in the fight against oppression. I haven't yet mentioned some of the post-colonial thinkers like Frantz Fanon and the African-American thinkers like W.E.B. Du Bois and some of the writers like Richard Wright. I mention all of these in the book. And of course, they were very interested in the fact that even though they all believed that there is a sort of core human dignity, they were very well aware of the ways in which other people can oppress the self or can deny or attempt to deny the humanity of the self. And so many existentialist thinkers were vigorously devoted to the problem of being with others, as they called it, not just being a self, but being with others and among others. And they gave great thought to the ways in which the interaction of self and others can be affirming or indeed sometimes denying of the human dignity. So Camus and de Beauvoir and Sartre and all of those other thinkers that I mentioned all spent a great deal of effort to try to figure out the kind of mechanics of freedom. That is, in what way is there a pushback from the world when I'm trying to assert myself? And in what way can a self among others be both affirmed in freedom, but also subjected to the oppression of others?
That's interesting. I wonder if, like, I'm just thinking of the United States of America and the Constitution and the Founding Fathers. And I'm just wondering if there may have been any existentialism influencing their thinking in this.
Well, in a way, I think so, because the historical roots of existentialism are quite wide and deep. So even though I point out that existentialism is a kind of a constellation of philosophical positions that arise in the 19th and 20th century, in fact, they draw all of the thinkers and writers that we associate with existentialism draw from the whole long tradition, beginning with Socrates as a kind of model of a philosopher who was very invested in the individual soul and in concrete living, making philosophy into concrete life and affirming the virtue of the individual soul. And there were other moments in the history of this thinking that supported a kind of turn inward and a self-reflection and a consideration of oneself in the world. So I mentioned a lot of those moments throughout the historical tradition, including the Enlightenment, which of course was directly influential for the development of modern democracies. And existentialism really wouldn't exist without those longer and deeper roots. The idea of freedom of the individual was an Enlightenment principle. And that is something that existentialists took and considered in a variety of ways. Of course, they were interested in the way in which freedom wasn't only for them a rational principle, that is a kind of principle of being able to decide moral right and wrong or political self-determination, but also the freedom to be able to shape oneself.
Right. And so how does existentialism, when you get into like, you know, moral decision-making and things like that, how does it relate to some of the world religions?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, there are a number of approaches in existentialism, some of which are very resonant with religion and others which are not. So Gabriel Marcel, for example, made the distinction between religious existentialists, which he included himself, and he mentioned Soren Kierkegaard, and one could mentioned Martin Buber and a number of other thinkers who thought of existentialism in terms that were quite compatible with a belief in a God, whereas there were other existentialists who were quite atheistic in their perspective. That would be Sartre and Beauvoir and Camus, for example. And still other existentialists made the idea of religion quite an issue worthy of critical scrutiny. And I'm thinking about Nietzsche, insofar as we consider him an existentialist. But he certainly shares a great deal of themes in common with the existentialists. And Nietzsche, of course, is famous for declaring that, quote unquote, God is dead. But what he really meant by that, he had a religious background himself, incidentally. What he really meant by that phrase is that he recognized living at the end of the 19th century and in a culture which was increasingly secularist, and in a culture in which the understanding of human life and of how reality works was no longer dependent on a religious explanation. And yet he thought we still lived in the shadow of traditional ideas about morality, which in the 19th century could be quite what we would consider now repressive. So there are a number of different ways in which existentialism can relate to religious thinking. So Kierkegaard, for example, is a deeply Christian thinker, and yet he felt very much at odds with the practices and attitudes of much of the religious culture in which he lived, which he thought was a bit too comfortable. It reassured people that they knew what they were doing, instead of directing them, as Kierkegaard thought it should, toward the idea that God is something infinite and vastly beyond us. And therefore, we must take a kind of radical transformation in order to believe in something that defies logic in Kierkegaard's sensibility. Lots of Christian thinkers, of course, did think that belief in God was wholly compatible with logical and rational argument. And they made exquisite arguments about the existence of God using reason. But Kierkegaard thought faith was something different altogether, that actually it was paradoxical and it defied reason and rationality and it required something else of us. So he would be an example of an existentialist who, despite being unconventional, is nevertheless very deeply religious. Other existentialists like Camus, for example, or Sartre and Beauvoir, reject the idea of God because they think that it's been a kind of explanation for the meaning of life that has supplanted our own need to understand a world in our own terms.
And with some of the religions comes there's the doctrine too, the rules for how you're to live your life and all of that, which again can be oppressive and can, compromise.
I would add though that there's also in many religions something quite very positive for us in terms of spirituality and living our lives. Religion can be a way of reflecting on our lives and our purpose, and it can give people means of communicating a sense of transcendence or spirituality or hope for a world that is better than the world that they see. And all of those things, I think, are compatible with existential self-reflection. Thinking about what we might be and what we might become ought to be compatible with a spiritual sense of the world, just as it's compatible with a sense that the world doesn't have any inherent meaning.
So I'm thinking about the having a level of anxiety related to uncertainty, to sort of really embracing uncertainty and how accepting that religion can also provide the comfort of the idea that, we know things, that we don't have to feel so unsure, that there are things we can comfort ourselves with, ideas.
Yes. One of the themes, of course, that comes up in many existentialist writings is the question of anxiety. Kierkegaard wrote an entire book called The Concept of Anxiety. And in Heidegger's philosophy, anxiety plays a very big role, as does the idea of being towards death or being aware of our finitude. And Sartre talked about anxiety and the sense of forlornness and despair that we can feel. All the existentialists were very interested in and reflective about the fact that uncertainty can create a sense of despair for the human being. So if we have a sense that the world is already figured out and that our place within it is fixed, and we're content with that, we may not be provoked to feel despair. But actually, there are a great number of provocations for anxiety in human life, whether we're existentialists or not. I mean, Schopenhauer, who's quite a pessimistic philosopher, wrote about the fact that even if life is very beautiful and wonderful, that very fact that we know that it's going to be taken from us with time, because of course we're all mortal, that alone is a kind of reason to be despairing. But on the other hand, there's also something quite amazing about the fact that we're here for a brief time and we have a certain freedom to be able to shape our interaction with the world, that it's a world of possibility. And though it is finite, there is a value in that as well. And sometimes being aware of our finitude can not only provoke anxiety, but can be a reason to embrace and appreciate what's around us, what we have, what we might be, what we might do with our time, etc. So I suppose what I would say about existentialist interest in anxiety and uncertainty is that they dignify it in ways that other philosophical or theological approaches might not.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I'm just thinking about another core concept, and I'm not sure how it's related, but that how the whole idea of authenticity ties in then to that as well. Like you said, if your circumstances are working for you and everything seems, you know, fine, then there isn't a level of angst or despair, whatever religious beliefs you have or whatever your circumstances are, feel good. But what about if you find yourself in a good situation and there's some conflict that just doesn't with like an feeling authentic?
Well, I think that existentialist reflection, by which I don't mean you have to be reading the philosophical books, but the fact that you're thinking about your existence can occur to us both in difficult times and in good times. So even when things are going well for us, I think it's very prevalent among us that even when we don't have concrete difficulties, we may be beset by wondering whether we're living the lives that we ought to live, or wondering whether we are taking a direction that really fulfills our innermost possibilities. And that is related to the idea of authenticity. So I think that probably most people who have had good experiences or a stroke of good luck, even they will probably admit that they know that they're susceptible to a feeling of uncertainty. And that comes with the sheer awareness that whatever life you have, whether it's good, whether it's troubled, whether it's difficult, whether it's tumultuous, it's only one life. And whatever it is that you do with that life has a great deal to do with your choices, even if, as we've said, so much of what happens to us and the world we show up in isn't of our own devising. So authenticity, I think, is a term that shows up in a lot of different existentialist texts, and it's sometimes meant different things are meant by it. But overall, I think the idea is reckoning with the sense of possibility that one's whatever what life one has and whatever choices one is making, it's a choice among other possibilities, and embracing that and accepting one's own freedom and contribution to that, I think, is what that's all about.
Is this something that you think is just natural to us as human beings? Does everybody reflect, or is it something that people need to be thoughtful about and remember to engage in some time to reflect?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I don't really know. I would imagine that human beings are quite diverse, and some people are going to be more, shall we say, prone to or susceptible to self-reflection than others. And I don't think it's a question of a value judgment whether someone who is deeply self-reflective is necessarily more authentic than someone who is not. But I do think that life as human beings experience it shares some universal features among all of us. I've mentioned finitude, our mortality. None of us can live forever. And we are aware of that fact. So that's one thing. But then the other one might be that every time we make a choice, we have to forego other choices. And that pertains to everyone equally. And another might be that if we make a mistake or regret something, we cannot turn time around and go backwards and do
People don't like that one at all. We can't go back and fix things in the past.
That's right. You can't redo it. You can reinterpret it, though, and you can take lessons that you learn from it and move forward in a new way. So, but those things, the fact that we can't reverse time, that we all are finite and mortal, and that when we choose one thing, we have to give up other things, those are all provocations to reflection, I believe. So I think that it's within pretty much every human situation or every human situation intact where the basic needs are met and one has a moment to reflect, that one may be susceptible to reflection. But I believe that's also a very good thing. That's also what allows us to think about our lives as possibilities.
Right. And I think, you know, at one point you were saying that for anybody who is kind of experiencing any kind of like a spiritual dilemma or struggling with something on a spiritual level, that existentialism can be helpful to them?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, one of the things that, as I mentioned earlier, that existentialism does is that it validates as a kind of worthy experience our experience of uncertainty. And that means that even spiritual uncertainty is a valuable and important experience. That doesn't give you a solution or an answer, but it does say that the question that you're asking is one that arises from the very fundamental features of your being human.
I have this had this reaction, like, I think my inclination is to be like, well, is this a useful way to spend my time, or is this somehow self-indulgent, or, you know, this idea. And what you're saying is a very comforting message, which is, if you're really struggling with something that feels worrisome and causing you a lot of angst, that in itself is worth acknowledging. Like, okay. And it's making me think of like mindfulness meditation, that there's a way in which you start with like accepting that this is how I feel right now and giving it attention, even if it's, you prefer not to be feeling that way.
Yes. Gabrielle Marcel once said something quite lovely, which is that traditional philosophy before existentialism often took concrete human worries and concrete human anxieties and real suffering and exiled them to some kind of disreputable suburb of thought. That's how he put it. That we think that because it's emotional and because it relates to our sense of uncertainty, that it can't be intelligent or intellectual or reflective. But actually, existentialism undoes that prejudice. That actually uncertainty is part of the human condition. And when we accept that, then it may make us feel a little bit more courageous in embracing the fact that every possibility that we experience, while, you know, negating other possibilities that we can't experience, it's ours. And the very fact that we're experiencing it gives it some kind of value.
So that, I wonder about the Western culture and how receptive you think the culture is. As I said, I think there are shifts and people are more willing to be open to these kinds of ideas. However, we're still pretty much a black and white culture where people are, you know, finding this is right, that's wrong, searching for where the problem lies, you know, and so this one.
Well, there's a place for that kind of thinking too. And there are a lot of problems that we need clear-headed, rational, empirical evidence and data for. You know, when we're talking about the climate or we're talking about inequality or we're talking about pollution or any of the concrete problems that we face, sometimes we need clear-headed thinking, rational approaches, and the kind of answers that scientists can help us find and figure out. But I also think that Western culture is quite confused because we're very individualistic. We're very materialistic. We're very much tuned in to a kind of global conversation. At the same time, there's a lot of, I think, need to reassess what is our real purpose for being here. There are a lot of directions in which we're going, for example, environmentally, where we're starting to recognize this isn't sustainable. And how might that have to do with my own choices in my own life, as well as with the larger social structures and so on in which we live?
That's nicely said. I think to some extent, there's some value then in saying that if there's some benefit to slowing down or pausing instead of continuing to just keep going full speed ahead. And so again, it goes back to like, even if it doesn't come easily to you, there's some probable value in reflecting and assessing and coming together to share ideas and to like, to, you know, get diverse opinions and together.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Sometimes life moves very fast. The demands on individuals for living and sustaining the lives that they live can be very high and very heavy. And making it through life is sometimes an encompassing endeavor, whether you have it relatively easy but are still beset by worries, or perhaps more materially difficult. I think that we are encouraged to participate in life in ways that aren't necessarily for the best for us or even for each other or for the world. There's a kind of endless push toward materialism. There's a sense of anxiety surrounding competition. There's a sense of having to keep up with others. And because of social media, there's an increasing anonymization of our participation in the social world. And I think that it's good to pause and remember the concrete nature of our experience, the reality of what it means to be an individual really in the world among real other individuals whom we interact with and with whom we might have better communities.
That sounds like something we need right now, you know?
Indeed, I think in a number of levels.
Yeah. So I want to thank you for giving us so much of your time today and just check in with you and see if there was anything else you wanted to address, or if there's anything you're working on now that you want to share with us before we let you go.
Well, thank you so much. Well, I do have a number of projects. One that I would probably feel comfortable speaking about is my interest in literature and its relationship to ecological thinking. So I've been working on a project that concerns how literary experiences might foster different possible ways of conceiving our relationship to nature and the natural world. There is a kind of burgeoning field of environmental humanities and environmental literary studies, and I hope to contribute to that, but I hope maybe in a way a bit inspired by this book, in a way that reaches out to a broader audience than what might have been my usual scholarly and academic audience alone.
That sounds wonderful, because my experience is that when I'm out in nature is when I often reflect the most or feel connected to some of those more universal experiences of life, the awe of the universe and, you know, nature itself. And
absolutely. One of the things I hope to have brought out in On Being and Becoming is that existentialism has never really been properly appreciated as a philosophy that stimulates environmental thinking. But I hope to have shown in a number of places that it really is not only compatible with environmental thinking, but it actually supports it in many, many ways. One of the beautiful things about thinking about our being here and our existing in this world is whether or not we want to take care of it and how we have to think about our interactions with it in order to be able to do it. I think a number of existential thinkers, including Camus and Nietzsche and others, promote our sensibilities and support in philosophical terms all those kinds of experiences of nature that you were describing.
Right. And And I think that's part of modern society is we're so disconnected. And you know, you do a beautiful job in the book of talking about, you know, our relationship with our world and, well, with others, but our world. And I think it's, yeah, it's really important. So this is exciting work that you're working on. And people can find out about this. Can they visit your website or what's the best way?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a description of all my books on the website as well. And there probably will be soon some more about the Literature and Ecology Project as well.
Great. And we'll make sure that that's in the blog too, so that people can look that up. Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing so much with us today and giving us your time. And I wish you well in your future projects.
It was absolutely my pleasure, Elizabeth. Thanks so much for talking to me.